So to move into our second speaker this morning, and as you can see, I mentioned earlier that we're very blessed and gifted to have the people that we have speaking on the topics that we have and how important this is for us to be aware of these encyclicals and these writings of these great people that God has sent to our church over the years and how we have to renew and bring this back into our culture in order to have a language to be able to address some of the things that are going on. So our next speaker is Dr. Peter Colosi, and he taught for 9 years at Franciscan University of Steubenville. I'm going to get this straightened out before we get started again. I think we can work it out because we had this done before. Under the speaker. That's why I'm moving it back here. So let's see, we get away from the speakers here. Hopefully we'll be all right. So as I mentioned, Dr. Peter Colosi has taught for 9 years at the Franciscan University of Steubenville at their program in Gaming, Austria as an assistant professor of philosophy. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And in the fall of 2009, he joined the faculty for St. Charles Borromeo Seminary in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, as an assistant professor of moral theology. He earned his B.S. in mathematics from Franciscan University, an M.A. in Franciscan Studies from St. Bonaventure University, and his Master of Philosophy and Ph.D. from the International Academy of Philosophy in the Principality of Liechtenstein. So I would ask you all to welcome Dr. Peter Colosi, and he's going to kind of vary his talk a little bit. He's going to talk about Humanae Vitae, but he has a little bit, I think, of a surprise for you that I think that you'll enjoy and find it very appropriate. So, Dr. Colosi.
Thank you. Let me just turn this on. The surprise that he was talking about, I just told him before I came up here, I want to talk about the HHS mandate and connect it to Humanae Vitae. And I wonder if any of you, maybe we could do a show of hands, were at the rally yesterday in downtown Philadelphia? Okay. Thank you. The reason I asked that is because I got there a little bit late. The third speaker was just getting up to the podium, and the first three sentences I heard her say were, "This is not about contraception. This is not about contraception. This is not about contraception," and that depressed me a little bit because I think it is about contraception. Now, I understand the argument, and that's what you're going to hear me talk about, the importance of the religious freedom argument. Now, one thing that made me glad about yesterday's rally, can you hear me? You can't hear me. Now you can hear me? Okay. You can't hear me. Okay. They can't hear me. Is Les here? This isn't on? The mic just went off, they said, I guess. So, we'll wait a minute here. I'll just talk maybe. Now is it on? Okay, it's on again, Les. All right. okay, so I don't know if you heard that the first lines I heard at the rally yesterday were, "This is not about contraception." And so I thought the whole rally was going to be only about religious freedom. And then to my surprise and gladness, there was a whole talk by a NAPRO technology doctor who gave his whole speech on the dangers to women and so forth. And there was another talk about how when contraception becomes widespread, women suffer disproportionately than men do. And now, this talk that I want to give today, and maybe some of you read, I published a couple of short articles trying to explain why I think we should be addressing contraception directly in this discussion, including the bishops. Okay, so I'm going to give a talk connecting the current situation with Humanae Vitae and try to figure out what Paul VI, the title of my talk that Les gave me was Humanae Vitae. He just left it wide open. So I want to say what Paul VI might advise us right now through Humanae Vitae. And I'm going to say some things about what the bishops have been saying, and I want to say at the beginning that I think what they're doing is good, okay? I'm not one of these bishop basher types. I just want to say that I think there's one dimension that needs to be discussed more by them in the form of leadership, okay? And so that's what I'm going to present. And I'm going to read the first part of my talk. So that'll take about 20 minutes. And then I have some other things to say, if I have time, about a certain dimension of Humanae Vitae itself when people are thinking about giving talks or homilies about it. Okay, so here we go with my talk, the first part. In view of what has been called the awakening of the sleeping giant of the Catholic Church, awakened by the recent HHS ruling, which states that U.S. employers must provide health insurance coverage cost-free for birth control, sterilization, and abortion-causing drugs, in view of that, the Freedom From Religion Foundation recently published a full-page ad in the New York Times with a $40,000 price tag titled, "It's Time to Quit the Catholic Church," March 9th. It was an open letter to liberal and nominal Catholics asking them to leave the church completely so as not to countenance in any way its irrational views. The authors expressed the irrationality of the Catholic Church by challenging liberal and nominal Catholics to ask their bishops this question. Does he, your bishop, hold up an umbrella against rain? Isn't that just as unnatural as using a condom or a diaphragm? And in a recent Facebook comment, someone asked me the following question. The logic of church teaching on contraception, by that logic, does it not follow that the church should also prohibit non-natural sweeteners? Now, on a side note, I answered that the world would be much better off if everyone freely chose to stop using both. But then I said that there's a difference in kind between these two things to the person. Now, I tell you these two true stories because I want to start by making very clear the baseline from which we are working in the effort to engage the culture boldly on the question of contraception. We are starting from ground zero. That is zero awareness, either intellectually or sadly experientially, that anything could be amiss, let alone immoral, with contraception. As hard as it is to believe, these people literally cannot conceive or perceive any differences that might exist between taking the pill and using non-natural sweetener in their coffee. This is one reason why the Catholic view looks completely irrational to so many people. The authors of that open letter to liberal and nominal Catholics also quote Nation columnist Katha Pollitt, who asked, "Is it an offense against Jehovah Witnesses that health care coverage will include blood transfusions?" And Pollitt also pointed out that the Amish don't label cars as an assault on religious liberty and try to force everyone to drive buggies. Now, the obvious implication here is that neither should Catholics, who are perfectly free to not use contraception themselves, hold on to the further claim that there is something intrinsically wrong with it, as this would be, in their minds, as silly as claiming that to drive a car is intrinsically immoral by the very nature of the act of driving, which is absurd. Now, on our side, Archbishop-designate now, William Laurie of Baltimore, who is also the chairman of the U.S. Bishops' Committee on Religious Liberty, in testimony before Congress on February 16th, used his parable of the kosher deli. Maybe some of you saw that. Okay. In order to drive home both the reason why religious freedom should be respected and the silliness of not respecting it when people can buy pork or contraceptives for cheap at the grocery store next door. And this analogy is helpful in that it serves to isolate and highlight a very serious dimension of the dilemma we are currently faced with, namely the complete dismantling of the First Amendment, as well as a dramatic first step on a very slippery slope, which would open the door to legal intrusions on religious freedom in who knows how many other areas. So the parable aids in gaining the broadest possible coalition of concerned citizens, many of whom have no qualms about contraception, but who share the concern about this very worrying precedent. In other words, if the government really was beginning its assault on religious freedom by making Orthodox Jews participate in serving pork in their delis, we Catholics certainly would join with the Jews in fighting such a mandate. So Bishop Laurie's parable is a very important part of this fight, and I applaud it. I applaud it for the reasons I just gave, okay? Nonetheless, between cars and the Amish and pork and the Jewish on the one hand, and contraception and Catholics on the other, there is a difference in kind. And so the analogy only goes so far, and there may be a danger in leaving it there. The difference in kind is an anthropological one, which goes to the very heart of what it means to be human. And this is why contraception enters the realm of morality in a way that sweeteners, cars, and pork do not. I have great respect for the Amish and the Orthodox Jews and of all the guidelines they choose to live by. But this difference in kind needs to be made explicit because it is so significant. Bishop Laurie's parable, perhaps wisely in that particular setting, namely in front of Congress, it does, though, leave the difference unmentioned. And I think leaving that difference unmentioned, I mean, maybe this is too dramatic of a way to put it. You can tell me if you disagree. I think leaving that dimension unmentioned will lead to defeat even on the religious liberty question. So, and I can explain. I'll explain that more as we go on here. And by the way, I know it's not being completely unmentioned. Yesterday I already said at the rally, and you'll see other examples in a minute. Unless there is an all-out effort to explain the Catholic view on contraception to the wider public and to Catholics in their parishes, we will lose the religious liberty fight. My goal in what follows is to explain why. One basic point to start with is that you have to have a critical mass of people who grasp a truth deeply and live it because of that grasping if you want any hope of a specific truth to make a positive impact on culture. That's a main point of Benedict's writings before he became Pope, like Christianity and the Crisis of Culture that he did with Habermas and his book with Marcello Pera. He's uniting with these atheists and agnostics who like the roots of Europe, but he wants to tell them, we can't have a culture based on Christian roots, even though you guys want it, without faith, because you need people who make God credible. You need people who are living the faith to make it credible to the other people to say, oh, maybe we should just live like they do, even though we don't believe in God. Now the question is, how many do you need? Cardinal Schönborn once was in a discussion about how many people would you need to live the faith to make it affect the culture, and he was just listening the whole time, and suddenly he blurted out 20%. So I don't know if that's the right number, but that's a first point to be made in this discussion. So the question now that I'm raising is whether the bishops should be doing that education in their campaign, or whether it should be only the priests in their parishes, or only lay people, or all of the above. And as you know, which I mentioned before, which is very heartening, priests and lay people have started doing just this education on contraception and the good news of the church's teaching in this matter, precisely because of this very debate, like at the rally. I'm sure you've seen other excellent examples. My favorite so far, I suggest you look it up on YouTube, is a talk by a woman named Gloria Purvis. There's a 7-minute video of her giving a talk at the Catholic Information Center, which is great. And I have the link for it if you want. And I've also found two homilies so far, and I'm sure there are more. One is by Father Philip Forlano of Philadelphia here, and that's online. He gave a homily right on this topic. And I found another one by a priest named Father Ben Cameron of the Confraternity of Our Lady of Mercy. There's a video of that one. He's from Kentucky. Really good homilies, which talked boldly about this question with clarity and compassion. So these things are starting to happen, which is kind of neat. So I think, though, now back to the parable of the kosher deli, that there are two reasons why Bishop Laurie's parable cannot convince the other side to whom he was talking that day. One reason is that they're just not interested in reasoned discussion. And we can talk about why that is. There's reasons why they're not interested in reasoned discussion, but I'm going to skip those right now. But there is also another reason why his argument, his parable, can't convince the other side. I think that if you asked the authors of the HHS mandate whether they think Orthodox Jews are being immoral in not allowing their people to eat pork, or whether they think the Amish are immoral in not teaching their children to drive cars, the writers of the HHS mandate would say, no, those things are not immoral. But they do think that the Catholic Church is committing an immoral and irrational, and they would probably say inhuman act. Even an abuse against women, they call it a war on women, by morally prohibiting contraception. And that premise that the church is doing something like that, that seems to be held in a certain way by by many Catholics too, to some degree or another. I read a poll. I'm going to read from a comment on the poll by the Public Religion Research Institute, which indicated that 56% of people surveyed, including 6 in 10 Catholics, indicated that they do not believe that their religious liberty has been threatened by this mandate. The study also found, I have a link to the poll too if you want it. The study also found that 55% of Americans, including 58% of Catholics, agree that, quote, employers should be required to provide their employees with health care plans that cover contraception and birth control at no cost. So why is that? Why do you think that is? It's because of what I said at the beginning. With respect to the truth on this matter and communicating it, we are at ground zero. And it is more. It's more than just being at ground zero. These Catholics and others likely also have the premise, vaguely floating around in their minds, that contraception is good, morally and health-wise. Morally and health-wise. And my point is that that premise that's floating around in the minds of people, if left unchallenged and unaddressed, has the power to thoroughly undermine the argument for religious freedom. I think to the point of losing the argument, but maybe I'm being too dramatic there, you can tell me. Because the religious freedom argument does have force to it. It is building a big coalition of people. Now put it this way. Here's another way to put my point. According to Catholic social teaching, the state does have a role, a well-defined role, but a role to regulate society juridically. You might not think that listening to many conservative voices, but it's the Catholic Church holds that there's a role for the state to regulate the market, too, by the way. It's just the way it's being done might be wrong right now. Now, to take an extreme example of this point, if there were a religion doing human sacrifices, the state is in its rightful role to stop that. The authors of the HHS mandate think of the Catholic prohibition of contraception as akin to that example of human sacrifice, a religion doing something like that, because they think they really believe that contraception is the best thing since sliced bread in the service of the common good. You know, I don't know if you follow what goes on at the United Nations, but right now the United States, there was just a conference on women. They have these annual or every 5 years. The United States right now, because of the administration we have, is pummeling the other countries to change these language in these treaties, which have never been in these treaties, to actual. This is the first time ever, last week, contraception, the word contraception, and these other little countries are fighting back, you know, and saying and the United States is doing all this trickery. If you read CFAM, the Friday Facts, if you look at yesterday's edition, it gives a very good summary of that. So they think contraception is going to be the cure to all the world's problems. They think that, okay? And so to diminish the cure to all the world's problems is immoral. Now, in this regard, getting to Paul VI, I am very struck by a remark in paragraph 17 of Humanae Vitae, where Paul VI, as far as I read it, makes the exact same point I just made, by posing this startling rhetorical question. He says, who will blame a government which, in its attempt to resolve the problems affecting an entire country, resorts to the same measures as are regarded as lawful by married people in a solution of a particular family problem? In other words, that quote, I think it means, if everyone thinks contraception is helpful in their own personal lives, then you have lost any basis on which to blame a government for using it to solve larger problems, especially if the government has a role to do that. So I think Paul VI agrees with this point. That is my main reason for thinking that this particular religious freedom fight, leaving that false premise unchallenged, undermines our whole effort. And I think he thinks that too. Catholic social teaching, by the way, also maintains that there exists a right to basic health care. You can find that in the compendium and various social encyclicals. A right to basic health care is part of Catholic social teaching. Now, whether it should be administered by the government taking over the entire health care market, the church doesn't teach that. But there is a right for everybody to have basic health care, according to Catholic teaching. Now, given the premise that contraception is care, why couldn't this mandate also be an example of fulfilling that point? So this false premise in the minds of these Catholics, it also indicates another interesting conclusion beyond what I've said so far. We would be much more likely, in fact, to have these people who, these other Catholics I'm talking about, on our side if the current battle really was over pork or cars. They would feel genuine pity, and rightly so, for the Jews or the Amish so intruded upon. They would ask, why does the government even care what those people do with their food and transportation? Maybe some of them would, in a nostalgic way, even long for the simplicity of the way those people live. But they would certainly not see any reason to think those lifestyles immoral or unhealthy. Quite the opposite. They would surely understand that the state has no legitimate interest in forcing Jews to sell pork to non-Jews who enter their store. And the reason for that is because there is no moral or health question at stake in those cases. There isn't one. That's why. Okay. Here, another approach is the approach of Cardinal George of Chicago, who in a widely read piece said the following. If you haven't already purchased the Archdiocesan Directory for 2012, I would suggest that you get one as a souvenir. On page L3, there is a complete list of Catholic hospitals and healthcare institutions in Cook and Lake counties. Two Lents from now, unless something changes, that page will be blank. End quote. That's what Cardinal George said in his famous letter. And the Cardinal, in that same letter, goes on to make a strong case that there are only four options for Catholic hospitals. I'm not going to list them now. None of them good. And one concludes that he is, in fact, spot on in his analysis. Those pages will be blank because the hospitals really will close. He's right about that. And here, too, I applaud Cardinal George's letter. I applaud it. Just the same way I applaud Bishop Laurie's parable. But I also ask myself, in some sense or another, which I hope to define a little more as we continue here, they leave the most important thing undone. Cardinal George's letter does accurately tell what definitely will happen two Lents from now. So that's good that he points that out. And the letter also, I think, is supposed to make people get up and do something if they don't want their Catholic hospitals to close. Although it may have some success in that regard, I don't think his accurate and undeniable prediction alone can affect the amount of action he desires unless it is coupled with a robust defense by the Cardinal of church teaching on contraception. Beyond the objective reason that the church will close hospitals before participating in intrinsic evil, and that's true, they will. If people understand that, do you know if the Cardinal keeps saying, which is good that he's saying, there is such a thing as intrinsic evil, and at this level, it does mean that we will close our hospitals. That's what he's saying, and he means it. But that's an objective fact about a precise indication of morality. And it is good to tell people that. It is good. Wakes them up. Shocks them. Really? They'll close it? But in addition to that, people need to understand why the hospitals will not participate. It's different to show the reasons for a precise indication than just to assert the precise indication. That, I'm going to say at the end of my talk, is the whole reason for theology of the body. If you think about Humanae Vitae, it's a very short document. And it does, theology of the body, in theology of the body, John Paul says that Humanae Vitae tried to give an adequate foundation of the teaching in Humanae Vitae. He actually says that, tried. He's not criticizing Humanae Vitae. He's saying that Humanae Vitae, the main purpose of it was to express the precise indication. The whole world wanted to know, is the Pope going to say yes or no to contraception? And the Pope said no. And then he gave some of the anthropological reasons in Humanae Vitae. But John Paul II, the whole point of theology of the body, he even says it in there. I'm going to take this one little passage, he says, and I'm going to express philosophically, historically, theologically, as richly as I can, based on my own experience with all these young couples, as Father said, the reasons why, so that people will interiorize those reasons and live the truth of the teaching because they grasp the happiness it will give them. In fact, did you know this? I'm kind of going to the end of my talk without wanting to, but in Humanae Vitae, one of the things I noticed in preparing this talk is the theme of the whole encyclical is happiness. It's in the first and the last paragraph. It names the word happiness, and it's talking about happiness, if you notice that. And he also says in there, when he's talking to the bishops in particular, he says that if this teaching is spread, it will create such goodness and you know, happiness for the whole world in the church if people interiorize it and live by it. So the whole like push of Humanae Vitae is about happiness and also about love as the foundation of the deep abiding happiness that will come. That's a surprising thing about Humanae Vitae. It's not just a... Okay, so I'm going to come back to that later. Recently I was expressing this point, namely my friendly constructive criticism of the bishop's approach to a friend of mine who, in defense of the bishops, said this to me in an email. He couched his answer to me just with respect to Bishop Laurie's. He says, regarding Bishop Laurie, I thought it was an analogy that was effective in the way he most likely intended it. The reality is that this administration is a bunch of zealots not open to a serious discussion of facts or reasoning. What he, Laurie, was doing was making a simple case to affect public opinion. I think most Americans would see that the religious liberty case he makes is common sense. The contraceptive debate is much more complex and has to be prudently approached. When most Catholics have no clue, it is hard to try to use sound bites to convince the culture to leave the padded cell of insanity it is in for truth and personal dignity. He said that. That was a good line. And then he goes on to talk. He's the one who sent me the homily about Father Ben Cameron. He said, we need more homilies like this one to bring the culture back. Richer ways to bring the culture back. Okay, that's what he said. Now, so my friend there who wrote that, he holds that in front of Congress, Bishop Laurie hit the nail right on the head. And perhaps that is correct. But even if it is, it still leaves open the question concerning whether there are other ways in which the bishops could be helping on the contraceptive front. Because the contraceptive front is now growing. I was so surprised yesterday at that rally how much it was talked about. I did not expect that. I thought the whole rally was only going to be about religious freedom. So in paragraph 30 of Humanae Vitae, we find ideas that could maybe help us in this discussion. Now, paragraph 30, you recall, is in a set of paragraphs of Humanae Vitae in which the Pope makes specific addresses to different groups. So, you know, he talks to men of science in this way, husbands and wives, doctors, priests, and then bishops. And this is what the Pope says to bishops in 1968. We invite all of you, we implore you, to give a lead to your priests and to the faithful of your diocese and devote yourselves with all zeal and without delay to safeguarding the holiness of marriage in order to guide married life to its full and human Christian perfection. Consider this mission as one of your most urgent responsibilities at the present time. As you well know, it calls for concerted pastoral action in every field of human diligence, economic, cultural, and social. End quote. Now, the urgency of that summons was in large part due to the ripeness of the teaching moment at the time of the encyclical's release, because the eyes and the ears of the world were on the Pope's every word. They were perked up. And that is the best moment to, as St. Peter says, give a reason for the hope which is within you. When someone asks, and they're them being perked up, they were asking. And this moment right now is like a reincarnation of 1968. In both cases, the whole world has its ears perked up about contraception. The first time, and I'm going to qualify this, I'm not being harsh right now. The first time there was deafening silence from the bishops and maybe all of us, we should say. And you know what? And this is what I'm going to qualify with. In one sense, I don't blame them. In a specific sense, I don't blame them. In one sense, it was very understandable. Because maybe it's true that they didn't know what to say. they didn't know, and we didn't know, how to explain the teaching with richness. We had the precise indication, but it took all these years to get the richness of the understanding. But now we know so much, as you heard in some of the speeches, as you find in Theology of the Body, there's all sorts, the health question, the relationships question, and so forth. All of you are experts on that more than I am. And we know all the ways to explain it to people. So my question right now is, with this reincarnation of the moment of 1968 right now, with the whole world having their ears perked up to this question, is how often in life are you given a second chance like this? It's like that old saying, if I only knew back then what I know now. But now, it's back then, right now. It is back then, right now. And so now I look forward to hearing your thoughts on how best the bishops could fulfill this urgent summons of Paul VI to educate on all fronts, as he says. And certainly, I grant, wisdom is needed. Wisdom is needed on how to do it. Maybe he was right in Congress just to do that. I probably was. But wisdom is needed. But to balk at this moment, to remain silent on this point again, I think is an error. That would be a tragic case. That would be a tragic case of history repeating itself. One which portends the disastrous consequence of cementing in the minds of many, if we're silent, the false mantra of the opposition that contraception is health care. Silence will cement that, because the other side says it over and over and over and over and over. And so people just believe it. And so if you're at least not ready with, you even have to be ready, I think, with a few sound bites. One of the things I think is, if some of the people are on TV, that they should be mostly maybe talking about religious freedom in that setting to keep the consensus. That could be true. But when the question comes up, I don't think the best tactic is, this is not about contraception. This is about religious freedom. I think the best tactic at that moment is, with courage and joy, and if you're a bishop, with that sort of fatherly demeanor that they have, to have a few things ready that you could say that are brief but thoughtful, which could cause an open-minded listener to just do a double take. Say, oh, I never quite thought of it that way. If that would be a success, just that would be a success, to start chipping away at the... But I think my friend who wrote me the email is right, that the real work needs to be done in the parishes and in talking with your friends and all that. That's where the real culture changes. But I do think that I don't know if I should even say this, but sometimes I think it's not about religious freedom. It's about contraception. Because I almost think that that the other side might be glad that we're only talking about religious freedom, because, you know, I've read, now here I'm going away from serious research I've looked up, but I have read some news stories that there are exemptions for a whole list of religions, like Christian Scientists and Amish and Muslims and so forth. One of the ones that pops into my head right now, and I'm not definite about this, so don't quote me on it. You have to look it up. But I did hear that there is an exemption for Muslims, because some groups of them believe that gambling and risk-taking are sins. And they equate insurance with that. I've heard this. Maybe some of you know more about that. And so there's an actual exemption, I think, in the HHS whole system, a conscious objection, that if they decide not to get insurance because of that, they won't have to pay the penalty of being uninsured. Now, the first thing I want to say is, that's great. That is, I mean, first of all, I think the whole mandate and the whole Obamacare we need to start from scratch. But if it exists, then what I just said about the Muslims, that's a good conscious objection. Okay? But what's interesting is, and I wrote this sentence down, my own sentence to express this. What's interesting is, not wanting to participate in gambling because of your religion, that can be a reason in conscience that the government will respect, it seems, if that's really an exception in there. But not wanting to participate in contraception can't be, according to them. That's not allowed to be a reason. Gambling is allowed to be a reason for an exemption, but participating in contraception is not allowed to be a reason. So that makes you think, doesn't it? Wait a minute. This isn't about religious freedom. This is about contraception. There's one thing that they want to make sure is as widely spread as possible. And so you could think of this as the whole freedom of religion fight is a smokescreen so that they can still get the contraception through that they want. And if you look at what they're doing at the UN right now, it's off the charts. You really should read the Friday Facts from yesterday. So that's another little theory that popped into my head thinking about this. Okay. So I look forward to hearing your thoughts on how best the bishops could fulfill this urgent summons of Paul VI to educate on all fronts. Certainly wisdom is needed, but to balk at this moment, I said that already. Not only should we be doing this education in the fight for religious freedom, but even if, God forbid, we lose that fight completely, we still should be making the case, at least to Catholics, that Humanae Vitae made in 1968, and which was profoundly deepened by John Paul II in Theology of the Body. I think that this moment is the proverbial teaching moment, and I also think that the goal of the bishops and other Catholics in these discussions should be to come forward with well-reasoned points, which will cause women, but everybody, but women in particular, to rethink, you know, whether they really want to be on the pill. That was a good thing about the rally yesterday. I said this part already. This is another thing you might think is too big of a goal, but I think our best bet is to persuade people to stop purchasing contraceptives. Now, you may think that's a long shot to achieve the shutting down of the contraceptive industry by convincing people to freely choose to stop purchasing it out of a deep understanding of the goodness of the truth about conjugal relations. It's nice to say that sentence because that's what it would be. You know, people would that would be the reason why they really would stop purchasing it. But that is what we're called to do, even though that goal seems far off. We're called to work towards it. And another point to think about in this is that at the moment we don't have power. We don't have power. We have truth, but we don't have power right now. We have power of our voices with the rallies, but I mean the power that can enact a new mandate every day, which is what's happening, by the way. You know, the whole mandate was, according to the press, while the president was giving his accommodation speech, if I got this right, it was being published in the Federal Register at the same time, unchanged. So that's power. And you know, you've seen some of the other things. Like on March 16th, they released the HHS released its advance notice of proposed rulemaking on preventive service policies, which added a new final rule to the mandate under student health plans, which says that they will gain the same consumer protections other people with individual market insurance have, including coverage of preventive services without cost. So all college students. And these type of new rulings, they'll be a common occurrence. In fact, this week, there's another one maybe you saw. This week, it was announced that there is a mandate tucked within the insurance mandate called the abortion premium mandate, which states that everyone who buys insurance from a company that includes abortion in its coverage will make two payments, $1 per month for abortion and another payment for the rest of the services covered. That's in there, too. And pretty soon, all insurance companies will be the ones that do that. So we don't have they have power right now, and we have truth, and we're supposed to speak truth to power. That's what you're supposed to do, and we have the truth about procreation, marriage, conjugal relations, and happiness, a true, deep, abiding happiness. And so I think all of us, the laity, religious, clergy, and the bishops, should be speaking truth to power, and we do need. I do think, and I'm trying to be as nice and gentle about this because I'm amazed and so grateful that the bishops are all unified in doing this. And I'm just adding one small point that maybe some leadership in an imaginative way, in a public way. It might be that it'll just be in their diocese. It might be that it'll just be with private discussions with their priests to encourage them all and give them resources to be able to create homilies on a wider scale, not just one or two. Homilies or seminars, like all of you can go to parishes and do seminars there with the encouragement of bishops and priests, And I heard that the bishops are going to do a national ad campaign very soon, but I don't know the content of it, a big one. But I would, if I were like on a committee, I would be trying to think of ways to, of course, the whole ad campaign I think is going to be about religious freedom, but I would be trying to think of ways that could work, you know, like use your imagination to just do that, get people to do that double take that I was talking about before. Not go out there and saying, we're going to criminalize contraception, but think about the deep reasons for the goodness of our teaching and get ways that will make people who are open-minded to say, oh, huh. That would be good to have in there. Now, for some reason, I don't know if I left my phone over there, but I have no idea how long I've been talking or what time it is. Oh, here it is. Oh, there's a clock. Big clock right there. all right, so I'm a philosopher, see. I have another section here, but I would like to see if there are questions. Maybe I'll just briefly mention what my other section was going to be. Do you have burning questions on this topic and we should just go into them? I can make an executive decision if you don't have a thought. All right. Well, the thought is I'll try to encapsulate it. Before I said that the theme of Humanae Vitae is happiness. Okay, it's happiness. It really is, and the happiness that flows from a deep abiding love. You know that in church, in the moral teaching of the church, on conjugal relations and contraception specifically, which goes back to our beginnings. There were forms of contraception way back when, time of Augustine and so forth. The magisterial documents and the fathers of the church, they always spoke in terms of the three ends of marriage, which are procreation, mutual help, and remedy for concupiscence. Procreation, mutual help, and remedy for concupiscence. And and by the way, remedy for concupiscence, it comes from, there's a scriptural verse in 1 Corinthians 7:9. It says, if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to be on fire. You know that verse? Now that verse, the reason you laugh is because... it can be easily misinterpreted to mean that marriage is the place where I am permitted to vent my lust. And that is false. And that verse shouldn't be interpreted that way. And I'm not going to do a scriptural exegesis on how to deal with that. But the true meaning of remedy for concupiscence is that marriage is the place where love can flourish to the point of dissolving lust. Marriage is the only place that that can happen. That's the real meaning of remedy for concupiscence. Now, this idea, the love that can do that, I said in church teaching from St. Augustine to now, until 1930, everything was talked about in terms of the three traditional ends of marriage. And then, you know, in 1930, the Anglicans had their Lambeth Congress, and they decided that they were going to allow contraception, they said, for serious reasons. So for the first time in the history of Christendom, they broke that teaching. And in the very same year, Pius XI wrote Casti Connubii, which you know. And the reason he did it so quick was because he wanted to get right on the stage and say, we're not caving. And in there he says contraception is a sin. But something very interesting happens in Casti Connubii. He adds what he calls a new secondary end. Now, later popes don't refer to it as a new secondary end. And the word for it is the mutual fostering of love. The mutual fostering of love. So he talks about procreation and mutual help and remedy for concupiscence. And then he says, mutusque fovendus amor, as a new secondary end. And then he describes it, the quote's in here somewhere, but he says that, then he starts talking in there, Pius XI, about the three traditional ends, and he says that they can, I'm paraphrasing, they can only be fulfilled if they are rooted in this rich spousal love. This rich spousal love. That should imbue couples when they're thinking about fulfilling the three ends, when they're thinking about living according to the three ends of marriage, it has to be colored with, if you will, imbued with the spousal love. And in Humanae Vitae, you remember, at the beginning, the Pope says that there's a whole list of things nowadays in the 1960s that are making people think we got to change this teaching. That's how he opens Humanae Vitae after he talks about happiness. And he lists them all. He says, oh, the social changes make it hard to raise a large family. Science has figured all this stuff out. What are some of you know the list. But one of the things, it's a long list, and one of the things he says in the list is there's a new awareness today that there wasn't before of the importance of conjugal love, of spousal love, and the relationship of that love to conjugal acts. All right, so Dietrich von Hildebrand, and I was talking to Dr. Ruppersberger before the talk, and he said, I can't read that guy, it's too hard. But the thing is, the reason I bring up Hildebrand is because in 1925, he gave three lectures at the University of Innsbruck where he talked about love, the love between man and woman. And he basically said that church teaching, of course the church, if you think about the commentaries on the Song of Songs, the church has these beautiful meditations on love, male-female love. But I'm just making a narrow point. In the moral documents about contraception, it wasn't emphasized that you could make an argument against contraception based on spousal love. And the teaching of Hildebrand, which I recommend this book, it's called Love, Marriage, and the Catholic Conscience. And the original title was The Encyclical Humanae Vitae, A Sign of Contradiction. But they redid it, and it's a great book, and it really takes Humanae Vitae and love and sees how... And so, after Hildebrand, you'll see if you read this, he was against contraception totally. But one of the things that happened because of those lectures is everybody started talking about this unitive and procreative meanings. And if you look at all church documents from like Gaudium et Spes, the 1983 Code of Canon Law, Gaudium et Spes, the Catechism, Theology of the Body, Humanae Vitae itself, it doesn't use the language of the three traditional ends. It talks about unitive and procreative meanings. A lot of people got mad. This is a change in church teaching. And the way to understand this, and so, this is very interesting too. It was the dissenting theologians and, for lack of a better word, the ultra-traditionalists. Those are usually thought of as opposites, right? But the dissenting theologians, they loved the fact that the church switched from the three ends to the two meanings language because they believed that the love idea could bear the whole weight, the whole moral weight of making conjugal relations morally acceptable. And then the procreation, since these are equal, I'm doing a very chopped job to express their view. But they thought, look, procreation, it won't happen. The woman could be already pregnant. She could be all different reasons why she couldn't get pregnant. Why not just throw another one on there, contraception, and we'll let this new thing, love, be what makes it morally good. They made their argument. But the ultra-traditionalists, they didn't like the love argument because they thought that it also opened the door to contraception. So they thought that this was a heresy, this unitive meaning. And so the liberals and the ultra-traditionalists on this fight, you think they're opposites, but they're the exact same. They both believe that introducing the unitive meaning into the argument necessarily opens the door to allowing contraception. And so Humanae Vitae said, it says right in Humanae Vitae, it keeps saying, we have to get a precise analysis of love. Because the truth is that the unitive meaning and its connection to the procreative meaning enriches and confirms the traditional teaching. And all these people have obfuscated. They've used love and they've tricked people into thinking it opens the door to contraception. But I better stop because now there's only 7 minutes. But I think that I would encourage a sort of personalistic approach in giving speeches, in addition to all the speeches about health and so forth. I mean, I have one that I've tried and a talk I give about where I talk about a personalist understanding of this body-soul unity. And I say, you know, there's this syllogism you often hear. People argue against contraception. They say, well, you have to give your whole self in marriage, but contraception means you hold back your fertility. That's not your whole self. Therefore, it's immoral. Now, that's good. It's logical. But the personalism of somebody like Hildebrand and Theology of the Body, although it's more hard to read than Hildebrand, it fills up those syllogistic arguments with richness. So, for example, if you explain the body-soul unity and get the audience to really feel the closeness that they are, spiritual bodily union, while they're sitting in their chairs, and there's a way I do that in my other talk, and then you say something like, you know, women, they experience their fertility more palpably than men do because of their cycle and how it you know, touches all these different dimensions of their daily life, spiritual, physical, bodily, emotional. So women, they experience their bodily spiritual unity as integral to their fertility in a way that is a little bit separate for men. And so if a man says to his fiance or wife, you know, if he says on the positive side, I love you and I want to understand everything about you, including your cycle, and I want us to live our marriage in tune with that. If a woman heard those words, then she's going to feel in her bodily spiritual unity affirmed in her being. It's not just a syllogism anymore. But if he says, whether he says this or not, telling her he wants her to use the pill does say that. If he says something like, your fertility is annoying me and I'd like to delete it. Well, that is going to have, that's going to have at some level of her being an experiential of the opposite of affirmation, of her person. Okay? And that's a quick way to say what Hildebrand is trying to do in his books. He's also got a short one called Marriage, the Mystery of Faithful Love, which is good. He's trying to get this sort of personalistic way, in addition to all the arguments we have, to add one more to help people in the pews or whatever say, oh, you know, think about it. If a man, I just said that like from the point of view of the woman, if a man understood everything I just said in my little example, what does that do? With that knowledge about her body-soul unity, it gives him power to love her better. He can find a reason in that. Oh, this is going to affirm her very being? That's the type of thing that Hildebrand was trying to do. And that's getting closer to the precise understanding of love that Paul VI wanted. None of this sort of using it to allow contraception, but the work of explaining the precise indication, the precise meaning of love, to show that it confirms and deepens the truth of the teaching. That's work, but it's doable. Okay, thank you.
Oh, look at all these hands. Thank you.
All right. Okay, the order of the questions I see right now went 1, 2, 3 as far as fastness of getting their hands up.
2 points that I see, both as a male and as a women's healthcare provider.
Yeah.
Referable to your suggestion as to how we need to approach this whole issue. The 2 points are, number one, I think women need to be at the forefront of speaking this message, because as a result of feminism and as a result of the women's liberation movement in the early 70s, the way it's being portrayed is, this is a woman's right and all of the abortion issues are about, it's my body, I can do with it what I want. And when I, as a male, try to explain the health issues or whatever to a woman, well, you wouldn't know you're a male. And when we talk about this to pre-Cana couples, we hear the same thing, we get the same resistance. So I think that women, in answer to other women, mothers teaching daughters, daughters teaching sisters, you know, and having this conversation, that women need to be at the forefront of this, at least to start the conversation. Mm-hmm. We need to meet the contraceptors where they are, and almost 95% of the contraception is used by women.
Mm-hmm.
And the second issue is that there is a health issue. And I think that is where we can get them.
Right.
If we can get them engaged and say, you know, this is not healthy for you. This is not women's health.
Right.
We won't get into the argument of preventive care because nobody knows what that is, and the government's redefining it. So they're called, you know, the only thing that contraception will prevent is pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got it. Pregnancy is a disease. Your
right.
fertility is a disease.
Yeah.
It needs to be controlled and managed.
Right.
So I think that women need to be engaged in this conversation a lot more because that's who Satan went after
right.
first with the temptation with the apple.
Right.
And they are the ones that bring the new life into the world.
Right.
And because their fertility is palpable.
Right.
It is visible.
Right.
They need to be at the forefront of the conversation. And that's what the women on the other side, the senators, I won't mention their names,
right.
are saying, no, this is our right. We have a right to this.
Right. Now, there is, now, I'll just comment briefly. Yesterday, that was another great thing about the rally. They read the letter of Helen Alvarez and the other women. They read it word for word. And there was a woman up there who gave the talk about how women suffer disproportionately to men when contraception is widespread. And I noticed the Catholic Medical Association published a letter signed by four women doctors about the health issues. So maybe, you know, in the light of my talk, maybe what the bishops need to be doing is doing their leadership towards Catholic women, maybe more than Catholic men. Now, I did think yesterday that the doctor, whose name I didn't catch, I don't know if he's here. Okay, up there. Now, he was a man, but the reason why he had the... really had the attention of the audience is because of his expertise. So that men can do that too. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to thank you for your shout outs for Dietrich von Hildebrand.
Oh, okay.
And it's just amazing that such a wonderful, wonderful giant gets forgotten.
Yeah.
His two books, two little books about marriage.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, very prescient he was. And yeah, he's got one called In Defense of Purity, and then he's got one called Marriage, The Mystery of Faithful Love. And then he's got this one, Humani Vitae, a sign of Contradiction. And there's another one called Man and Woman, Hildebrand has. And he talks in there also about this. So, and it's just, I'm just telling you, it's one approach. Hildebrand's is only one approach. But what's interesting about his approach is, and there are people trying to do the historical research on this, I think there's enough evidence to conclude that he had a direct effect on the paragraph in Casti Connubii where Pius XI introduced what he called the fourth traditional end, mutual fostering of love. All the popes later, they keep it. They say that it should be the thing that inspires all the... But they don't call it anymore... a third secondary end. And if you're really interested in it, in the book Love and Responsibility by Karol Wojtyła, pages 66 to 70, and those pages of Love and Responsibility, 66 to 70, he explains very painstakingly why love should not be conflated with mutual help. It's a separate thing that informs all three. I'm not going to explain that right now, but I'm going to try to write it. Okay, Anne?
Yeah, I agree with what you said about the freedom, the religious freedom issue, because I think that's an issue, but I don't think it is the main...
Oh, so you agree with my more dramatic claim.
But I'm also wondering if it's right to say that it is about contraception, because I just read the other day that sterilization is now included.
Well, yes. And so is abortive fashioned drugs.
Exactly. Right. But specifically, I read about sterilization. This was with regard to the college students.
Right. Oh, wow.
I mean, why there are college students being sterilized.
Oh, it's terrible. They're going to regret it.
So we have sterilization, abortive patient drugs, abortion itself. And this is preventative care. So less is right. We're preventing the disease of pregnancy, I guess. But there are plenty of sexually active women who are contracting HIV. But given the theological anthropology,
right.
that we had this morning, is there something, what do you think? Is there something else going on?
Well, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist. If you look in the Gospel of Life, Evangelium Vitae, paragraphs 16 and 17, John Paul II says explicitly that there is a high-financed, well-organized, sort of supranational effort to spread contraception, sterilization, and abortion around the world. He says it in Evangelium Vitae. He says it. And then what he says also in those paragraphs, which is very interesting, he says that these people who are doing this, they're noticing problems. You know, people are starving in the third world, and they are getting malaria, and women are dying in childbirth. You know the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals? Those are good, actually. It's just they've been co-opted by the other side. And the Pope says in 16 and 17 of the Gospel of Life that they don't want to do the work that it would take to really help those people. So and if you listen to even the cardinals at the UN, they it's not a conspiracy, it's true.
Well, because on the other side, too, then we have physician assisted suicide and yeah. Euthanasia directly, and those kinds
right.
of things. So, I mean, it just seems like we're trying to get rid of people, or maybe it's only certain
yeah. people. No, yeah, there's a big effort in that. So I think, in these, we have to be like. I don't know if some student of mine just said, how do you read all this stuff? Noticing all the whole mess we're in, and he used a different word. Isn't it depressing? But the thing is, I think the truth is a source of hope and joy when you read it and think about it. And God is in charge. And so our goal is just to speak truth to power with love. And I think it went 1, 2, then 3, 4, 5. Oh, two more? Okay, the order was 1, 2. Yeah.
Would you mind telling me whatever doctor prescribed this for you, that you're seeing a psychologist with depression, and she thinks it's related to the pill?
Yeah. That I think what you just said is the real heart of it. You know, the personal relationships is better than, and maybe what you just said would mitigate my constructive critical thoughts towards the bishops. You know, maybe you really can't do it in a soundbite. Maybe it has to be cor ad cor loquitur, heart speaks to heart. So I don't know how they could do the leadership. There is something more to be done, but that's very beautiful. That's the heart of it. Back in the back there. Right. Right.
Right.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Right. And so. Yeah, and that would be just one comment on that. That would be another the environment. I am surprised that the green movement doesn't support the rejection, particularly of the pill type of contraception. They should be totally on board if they understood it. And then the other thing I would say is you're right. There's a fundamental view of the human being, one which says every person is infinitely precious. Like Mother Teresa, she said, every person, I consider my ministry as loving one person at a time. We don't admire her because she fixed a broken arm. We admire her because of the look of love she gave to the person whose arm she was fixing. And Peter Singer was mentioned in the last talk. He criticized her. He said, she's wasting her time. She should be calculating, speed limit options against accident rates in India. She'd save a lot more people. The utilitarians, they separate, like you said, suffering from the one who is suffering. And the Catholics don't separate suffering from the person. There's two values, the person who's precious and the suffering, which is a disvalue. And we don't forget any people. And they just want suffering to come down, no matter what. And they'll forget people. All right, thank you.